Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and of course, on our podcast. I'm A.D. Packham and we are applying our foundation in association with Flowers Unlimited. Well, with the international break giving us not an awful lot to talk about, both Alan Wares and myself are delighted to welcome back a man who has become an integral part of the Albion story, both on and off the pitch, for over 20 years. On the pitch, he played 206 games for the club, scoring 9 goals at a time when the club was kind of treading water and probably needed a bit of a steady head. And then off the pitch, he has been spearheading the various award-winning schemes for Albion, the community, now of course the Brighton Foundation, since he retired. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a very warm Albion Roar welcome back to Mr. Guy Butters. Hello, Guy.
But I bet you didn't realise your life was like that, did you?
I didn't. I forgot it all, to be fair.
It's all that heading of footballs. So we'll be talking about that later.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute, yeah. Can we just... I didn't realise actually it was as many as 206, but it's the 9...
It depends on who you believe.
Oh, I see. It's the 9 goals, of which I have to start with this guy. The one at West Ham.
Yeah. Brilliant, yeah, the good old days. Yeah, I keep getting reminded about that. I mean, the amount of people that come up to me and say they were there, you know, you'd think there'd probably be something like a 60,000 crowd.
This is very similar to Gary Nelson's goal at Brentford, isn't it?
Well, I think it's more like the number of people that were absolutely convinced they were the last ever gig for the Jam.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone can tell me how much I think something like 14 to 1. They was all lumping on me and all this sort of stuff for the odd set piece. I mean, I think it's probably about the only shot we had on target.
It was 40 to 1, actually.
It was my story. I saw it as I was walking into the away end at Upton Park. First player to score, Guy Butters, and Albion to win 1-0. In other words, us win 1-0 and Butters get the goal. 170 to 1. And I'm thinking, stick a tenner on. That's a happy weekend in the pub. But seeing as I don't bet, I'd rather have the win than the 1700.
And actually, at that particular moment in time, I mean, this is how fast times moved on. Now, obviously, everyone's got these sort of things on their phones now, but you didn't have apps on your phone back then.
No, it was like I say, it was on a chalkboard as I was walking in. I mean, yeah. Guy, that particular game has gone down in folklore. I mean, I think Virg's got sent off, didn't he?
Yeah. I think he had a little bit of a rut with the midfielder. Was it Robinson? But I do remember the actual start of the game. I mean, well, before the game, actually, we signed Steve Claridge on loan, didn't we?
Yep.
And people are upset because someone, he'd been given the number 25 shirt for the first time since Bobby.
Yeah. And then, so we were sort of like working on set pieces, you know, a week, et cetera, as you do. I do remember him having to get a train over to, I think we were in East London somewhere by Canary Wharf or wherever it was. And I don't know if it was the same hotel as the Lasagna Gate, but I do remember Danny Cullett on the way to the game, as soon as he literally walked in through the door. West Ham are very sneaky. They have they put the biggest policeman you've ever seen on the player's entrance. I think it's just to intimidate you. He must have been about 6'8" and about 6'8" wide. So Danny, I remember Danny sort of barging him out of the way because he literally was trying to go to the toilet to be sick. And he ended up getting their shorts. It was all over the floor in the dressing room, so we had to clean it up before we was allowed in. And it literally... touch and go whether he was going to play. But obviously, Danny being Danny, you know, he pulled his boots on. And then the first 20 minutes, I bet he wished he'd never. Because it was like the absolute Alamo. I mean, they hit the post. They hit, you know, it was goalmouth scrambles. Yeah. You know, how they didn't score, I don't know. And then, like you say, sort of like one of them games where we knew we were sort of holding on, really. But we always had a fighting chance, you know, if we could get a set piece. And then, as I said, we practiced set pieces, which was Richard Carpenter's always guarantee Richard Carpenter's delivery is spot on, you know, unbelievable delivery. And I remember going up for the corner thinking this could be our one chance to get a chance at goal. And he played it short to Steve Claridge. I was like, oh,
for those not who can't see this in reverb vision, Guy has just put his hands in front of his face, a bit like Bagpuss would, what the blazes is he doing? Anyway, carry on with the story.
Well, so, I mean, well, he's gone short, but in the end, it turned out not too bad because I started to make my way back. I thought, like, you know, he's going to get, something's going to happen. He's either going to overhit it or the keeper's going to come for it or it's going to get cleared. So I started to edge my way back, which gave me a tiny, like, a two-yard buffer between me and my marker. I think he thought I was running back, back to my position, so he sort of let me go. I think it was Cullen Davenport, I think his name was. So they gave me that little run up. So when the ball did actually come in, I mean, you actually watched the cross that did come in. I mean, it's on a sixpence.
It is.
So that gave me the momentum to get a little run on him. And any defender will tell you, if you've got a standing jump against someone who's actually got a running jump, you've got no chance of defending it. So I managed to sort of use him a little bit as a ladder and get my head on it. But all I do remember from that is the whole of the away end just erupting.
Yeah, because it was right in front of us, and then you ran around the goal, didn't you? Giving it
Yeah,
some.
I'm at the goal. But when I've seen it back, I mean, like I said, the defender weren't too happy. I think he starts chasing after the ref, thinking it's a foul, but
That's
it's.
West Ham for you.
Yeah, there's no chance he was going to give it. But and then again, it was sort of like, I think they brought Bobby on, they brought Rebrov on, they brought someone else on. It was like literally the Alamo again holding on. And
Yeah.
then when we won, it was like we was all sort of giggling again because it was, how did we win that? We'd done that quite a few times that season.
Yeah.
And then the celebrations in the change room, but also trying to get out of there on the coach. We got chased down the road by the West Ham fans, which was the coach driver kept stopping at every red light, and we was like, just go.
Go, yeah. Because they're very magnanimous, aren't they, West Ham fans?
And so every time the green light came and he went, that we'd wave at him, the sarcastic wave, see you later, and then he'd stop at the next one, and then they'll start catching up again. So all the, you can hear all the thuds on the side of the coach. But like I said, there must have been something going on because the next day I got some bug. So whether Danny had caught a bug somewhere or whether it was the food at the hotel, I don't know. So yeah, I was sort of bedridden for a few days, and I think Mel Stewart got a little bit of sickness as well. So there was a bit of blood floating around, but it was great. And the funny thing about it, when my dad, God rest his soul, is no longer with us, but he was a West Ham fan, so you can imagine how he felt.
Did he disinherit you?
Well, I think it was like one of them, and you felt like he'd lost a tenner and found a fiver. One of them sort
Yeah.
of things.
My main take,
Actually,
hang on,
speaking
Edie,
of.
my main takeaway from that, and I've said this so many times, was as I jumped up, I didn't have to clatter my leg on the because those seats at that away end were terrible. I didn't have to clatter my leg. I ended up with a really nice shiner on my shin.
You're always injuring yourself when guys score goals, though, aren't
Actually,
you?
yeah, that happened at Leeds as well, didn't
Leeds, you
it?
lost your glasses.
No, it wasn't my glasses. I actually lost, and I don't know if you were with us or not, but I lost the keys to the minibus that they fell out of my pocket as we were celebrating. I think that was an equaliser. Do you remember that one, Guy?
Yeah,
That was the 3-3, wasn't it?
No.
The Leeds one because
Oh, well, the 1-1. Yeah, I know.
yeah, their manager Kevin Blackwell, I think his name was. He before the game, as we were walking sort of down towards the changing rooms, he was coming the other way, and I held the door open, and he walked through, and he went, "Thank you," like that. And then as I've sort of gone through it myself, I heard him say to the steward behind me, "Who's that?" And they both started laughing. I don't know. It was a silly throwaway comment. Whether it was a icebreaker for him and the steward, I don't know. And then obviously, like you say, I scored the equaliser, and I bumped into him after the game. I let him have it a little bit. I think you know who I am now, mate.
Was that not the David Yeldell game?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. So I've got a great picture of me. I think I'm in the goalmouth marking. I think I'm marking someone like Clark Carlisle or someone who played for him. Might even have been Brian Deane might have been playing for him at the time. Someone like that I was marking, and he's in front of me with that shirt on. So from a corner we're marking. Yeah. So I've got that picture somewhere. But
That.
again, another game where it's a massive crowd and a hostile crowd again,
Yeah.
Wasn't Ian Hart playing that as well?
Ian Hart made he Yeldell made a world-class save from Ian Hart. And actually, and given how, I was saying about how magnanimous West Ham fans are, brackets, not really, Leeds fans, and that their cop end. I think I wouldn't say they gave him a standing ovation, but they gave him a decent applause as the game finished.
We had in the Players' Lounge after, I always remember we had a club rule where you had to go into the players' lounge and have a drink. And it didn't necessarily mean alcoholic, but you can have a Coke or something. But it was to keep everyone together because we had quite a few young lads around as well. So to keep everyone together, sometimes you get your little cliques of young lads into the same music and whatever else. So we made a rule, home and away, everyone's got to go in the bar, have a Coke or have a beer or whatever you wanted to do. So as we've gone in the Leeds players' lounge, there's no one in there, it's empty. And apart from, I think it was, is it Gary Kelly, the fullback? He was the only one in there, and he bought us a drink. He bought everyone a drink. He went, lads, that's so impressive that every single one of you is in here. He said, our lot, look at, I'm the only one in here. They've gone home. He said, that's what we like. So that team bonding and that sort of, The mentality of that season where we all stuck together and we was all in it together and we was all fighting for each other. A club like Leeds didn't have that sort of attitude, and hence why we used to turn them over or get draws against them.
Well, pretty much every game was like the Alamo, wasn't it?
Yeah, Sheffield United away. I think Leicester away, we beat them. Virg scored that sort of 20, 30 yard or whatever he did. Sheffield United away, like I said, scored just before half time and then
Was
scored
that
just
Reading as well? Reading away,
before.
was that season?
Watford, I think we drew away.
Well, you played in that game where Mark McCammon got pushed over the advertising hoarding as well, didn't you?
Yeah, that was that Sheffield, was that
That was Sheffield
Sheffield
United,
United
yeah.
away, wasn't it? Yeah.
Leon popped up on it at the end.
Yeah.
I think Kerry was relieved because he scored yet another own goal. But yeah, no, it was brilliant. But yeah, and like you say, we just used to come in after games sometimes thinking how have we sort of got result there. But as I said to you, we had a team spirit that season where we knew we were up against it, and it was not many teams wanted to come to the Wythdean. And I think we drew at home with West Ham as well. So we took
I think we
four.
did 2-2. Dean Hammond scored twice, didn't he?
Yeah, it was.
Wow. Can I
Actually, I
just,
mean, you
sorry, AD, can
go
I
on.
just put some context to this? Because we are talking, like I say, 20 years ago. I think Mark McGee will always tell you that, yeah, getting promotion from the old third division, League One, whatever it was called in those days, via the playoffs was one achievement. That was great. But he always feels that the bigger achievement was actually staving off relegation the following season. And this is the one that we're talking about here, think Guy, where we've got the draw at Leeds, we've got the win at West Ham, we've got the win at Sheffield United. And I just want to put context on this for
Sunderland.
anyone who wasn't necessarily sort of, realise this, is that how small a club in comparison to the likes of all these others that we're mentioning here, how small Brighton was. Obviously, we're still at Withdean. All the mo any money that the club can make is going towards the public inquiry. And the fight for the stadium. I mean, that was probably, one of the big markers of your time here, Guy. I'll ask you about that in a second, about the inclusion that you had to have towards the fight for the stadium. And Brighton, nowadays, you'd like to think could actually turn these clubs over. Back in those days, I think we probably, you and I, AD, will agree, we walked into nearly every game thinking, we're going to struggle here. There might be sort of
Never
three or
done it.
four.
I go into every game thinking we're going to win whoever we're playing, to be
Yeah,
honest. Yeah,
even
well,
Rotherham.
it's just that mentality. And Guy will tell you this: if you go into a game thinking you're going to lose, you know what? You probably will.
Well, there is that, but I mean the thing I've just mentioned there, guys, is that obviously you're in the backdrop of the club still fighting for the stadium. I mean, when you arrived, there was. We weren't even close to getting the stadium. We were actually being rejected. What was it like? You're talking about the togetherness when you're on the pitch, but was there a similar togetherness that maybe Dick Knight commandeered for everyone, to get everyone to face the same way for the bigger prize?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I was aware of it because I literally was playing for Gillingham when Brighton were ground sharing with them. So I was aware, obviously, that the pitch being used a lot. But in all fairness, saying that, the groundsman done a remarkable job because the pitch was brilliant down there at the time. So I was aware of Brighton's struggles before I signed. And then when I came down there, I think that they never took me anywhere near the Wythdean.
Where did they serenade you?
They took me straight to the club offices right in the middle of the town, which is not
Right.
far from the beach, obviously. And they went the beach way as well. They went along that road. And then I think my medical was in Shoreham. So they took me along that road, along the beach,
On the
obviously.
seafront, yeah. Oh, right,
Seafront down to Shoreham. So they kept me as many miles away from Wythdean as they possibly could.
It was
But
a
again,
well-travelled route.
yeah. But again, we knew what we were up against. We knew that there was a fight for the stadium. We knew, all the stuff that was going on behind the scenes. We joined in a few of the marches. We did, I think, when we played Wickham away, we held the banners up after the game, which made the press on the Sunday.
I ended
So,
up with your sandwiches, mate.
yeah. We were very much aware of it all, so we did as much as we possibly could to join in and do all that sort of stuff as well. So, and since then, I've sort of got the more of the backdrop from that because obviously I've met people like yourselves, and I've obviously met people like Paul Samra and all the people, the big hitters that were involved in it, and Dick Knight as well. And the other day, I met Lord Bassam, Steve Bassam, who had the Labour peer at the time, who I think he
Yeah.
had quite a few dealings with. John Prescott, but although he was telling me he wasn't allowed to approach him directly because it was classed as him They were worried he was sort of like bribing him or something, so he had to go by a different means. But yeah, it's a very interesting story. We'll talk about it later. Obviously, the group that he talked about was my Albion Memories group. So he'd done a very good talk there about all the fights that we had for the stadium and the sort of things that we had to go through. But and he said how well John Prescott actually did in the end, because he was a football fan at heart, and it worked out quite well in the end for us, obviously.
I mean, just to put some meat on the bones in regards to that, I mean, obviously you've had a long distinguished career both on and off the pitch with the Albion, but obviously you've played the likes of Spurs, Gillingham, Pompey and sort of stuff like that. So when you experience what we went through to get where we are now, how does that relate to experiences that you had at other clubs? Because, I mean, how unusual is it?
I mean, it's unusual because, when I was at Tottenham, they were having issues towards the end of my career there because that was just before Alan Sugar took over. So I knew they had money issues then. They had to sell Gazza and a few other players to balance the books. And at Portsmouth as well, they were going through a bit of a stage where they sort of half gambled on getting good players in, like Paul Walsh, and they had Guy Whittingham there. And we one year we got to the semi-finals FA Cup. The following year we lost in the playoffs to get in the Premier League, and then it was almost like a Leeds situation, where the money had sort of run out and they had to start selling players. Then we started having relegation battles, and then I do remember at Portsmouth we had a pre-season game in Le Havre, which is 4,500 away on the ferry, and there was 2,500 Pompey fans went over purely to run on the pitch at half time and get the game abandoned, which they successfully did in protest. So I've been at a few clubs where they have protested, but these clubs have always had the background behind them. They've had stadiums, they've had somewhere that they could call a home, whereas Brighton didn't. So it's a totally unique situation. We always say it, don't we? Not many teams wanted to play at the Withdean because basically we didn't want to play there. But we sort of turned it into our own fortress, if you want. And, like you say, it sort of turned out into our advantage at the time.
Sure. So, I mean, obviously, Brighton was your last professional club before. I mean, I know you had your time sort of in you dallied with management over in Hampshire, but you largely hung your boots from the big time at the Albion. But there was that kind of that hinterland. Like I say, you did some work with Jason Dodd. You went to, what was it, Eastleigh, was it?
Yeah, I've done that
You went
easily.
to Eastleigh. But then the Albion came back because, frankly, I mean, the fact that you were describing the togetherness, and I think that, you saying this from something that's 20, 25 years ago, and I think that's something that's now, because if nothing else, the club do bring a lot of ex-players back. I mean, I can give you an example of your togetherness. You, in public, with your teammates, did ring a ring of roses. But you were initially asked to help out with Albion, the community as it was then, but you had a certain level of reluctance to it at the beginning. What was your concerns?
To be fair, I knew roughly probably 2 years before the end of my playing time at the Albion, I was offered yearly contracts. So obviously the year that we got into the playoffs, I was offered a year, I think the, and then obviously since ever since. But in the talks with Dick Knight, and I think Mark McGee was there at the top stage, and then Dean Wilkins, it was always a case of, I think Dick really regarded the former players, highly, because he knew what we was like on the pitch and he wanted to replicate that off the pitch. And also at the time we did a lot for the community scheme off the pitch as well. I, as you quite rightly pointed out, I live in Hampshire, so I used to travel back to Southampton every day, and normally on the way back probably once or twice a week I'd get a little phone call from a lad called Tony Clark, who used to work there at the time, over the Chichester area. On the way through, can you pop into a school with me, can you give out some medals for me, can you do this, that and the other? And of course, yeah, always a pleasure. My sort of worry at the time, towards the end of my contract, I weren't told until literally an hour after the Swansea game when they got promoted as champions at the 15.
Oh, painful.
I literally was going in thinking, I don't know what's happening with my career. Am I getting another year contract? And it turned out that I wasn't. So my initial sort of worry was, well, a peeve, if you want, for a better word, was the fact that I didn't actually play the Swansea game. I wasn't even on the bench. So if that decision was already made that I wasn't getting another contract, I felt it was a little bit, off that I
You
didn't
didn't
get
get a chance to wave cheers to the fans, did you?
a chance to say goodbye or thank you or whatever it be. So yeah, that sort of stuck in my mind for a bit. And when your contract's up as a pro and it's that's it, it's finished, they very kindly, you get an extra 3 months' wages to obviously sort yourself out. Normally, your contract, I think, runs out at the end of June. I think it is start 1st of
June
July.
the 30th is usually the
Yeah, I
date
think this
contract
runs through
runs in.
till the end of August or something like that, or September. So it gave me a little bit of leeway to try and find. And funny enough, 2 days later after that game, I was going away doing my UEFA B coaching badge in Cheltenham with a load of ex-pros. And so as I went on that coaching badge, I literally was asking other people, what do you do now? And some of them were saying, well, I drive a lorry, I do this, I work here, I own a pub, I do whatever. So it was like literally thinking, what am I going to do? And I remember a conversation, obviously, with Dick Knight about coming onto the community scheme. Charlie Oakway, I think, was working on it at the time, and Alan Sanders was leading it up. So the conversation sort of went between, because literally after that, Charlie put a word in for me because he was coaching at Havant and Waterlooville. So not only did I get down there to play for Havant, Charlie then obviously put a word in for me at the community scheme. Come on, we need more ex-players involved, blah, blah, blah. So very lucky, I sort of, I think within the September I started, I went over to the community scheme. And then, like, as you said, 17 odd years later, 18 years later, here I am.
Yeah, you can't
Because
leave,
at
can
that
you?
point, no,
It's
because at
like
that
Hotel
point,
California. You can check out any time you like, but you can never leave.
and I'd never want to leave, to be honest, because it is,
Really?
you know, it's such a fantastic place. It's brilliant. You know, the scheme is, the foundation is, yeah, you've seen it in action, haven't you? And you know what goes
I
on.
mean, give us a flavour of what you were asked to do in the first instance. I mean, you mentioned about while you were still playing, just to do the sort of the whole, turn up, hand out medals and what have you. But when you were sort of like properly asked to join the scheme, what were you given apart from maybe a broom to sweep everything up?
Well, I used to go and do PE lessons in schools. I used to do things at after school clubs. I used to do the holiday courses in the holiday terms. I also used to, after a while, they got me into Basvic College. I used to run a football team at Basvic College, and I was helping with another lad called Scott, who worked at the foundation at the time, to put on coaching badges from level, I think it was level ones or level twos. So it was quite busy, yeah. So we had, and then on a Wednesday, we were playing games. You know, the college football was playing games against other teams around Sussex. So it was, yeah, it was brilliant. I loved it. Well, I still do. It's moved on, obviously, since then, but
Yeah, because when you first started, that you weren't necessarily alone, were you? Because you already mentioned Charlie, but you also had like Richard Carpenter, Chippy was there, Danny came and did it for a while.
Kelly,
There was a
Michelle.
load of you.
Yeah, there's about six or seven of us at the time. Obviously, you know, I think Artie still lived over wherever he moved to, and then he found a traveling too far. I think Kez ended up working, I think he's still working for communications.
Yeah, telecoms, yeah.
Others have gone off to work. I think some work for Russell Martin Foundation. I think there's Richard Carpenter was Kent boy. He's over Kent way, so I think he found a traveling a bit too far. So yeah, so it's one by one they've all sort of left, and I'm still here. So yeah.
So you're the last of the Bash Street kids.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, last of the gremlins.
Okay, well, the founder it's changed the name to the Brighton Foundation, obviously from our winning community, and it does do some amazing things. Just some foundation facts for you. 5,000 children and young people are helped every week. Over
Week.
500 people with a
Hang on,
disability.
AD, did you say every week?
Every week.
Wow. Sorry, I didn't realise the numbers were like that.
30,000 a year.
That's
30,000 people a year. So yeah, we've got so it says 600 players participate in the disability sessions per week,
Yeah.
and we have
150 schools
across Sussex.
across 35 towns and cities are part of the education
You have
programme.
to spread yourself quite thinly then, Guy, don't you?
But it is, like you say, it's right across. So it's, yeah, it's brilliant. You know, far up to Guildford, I think, and as far out as Eastbourne, and then all the way to Chichester. So
I was about
it's
to say, did you
that.
know that Hastings existed, or did you know that anywhere was that far east?
I've been over there a few times, yeah, and it is, yeah. I mean, it's eventful. What if you get stuck behind a tractor or something on the road?
It's almost in Gillingham, isn't it? So it's kind of
Yeah,
like, oh yeah,
well, I
not
used to
quite
travel
there.
there every day at one stage. That
But
was all.
I mean, since you've been like working with this game, you've done a lot of crazy things, from like trashing power chairs to sleeping outdoor, sleeping rough to lots and all sorts of fundraising. So, I mean, what are the things that have really stood out for you during your time so far?
Well, we used to do a bike ride every year around Europe. That stuck out quite well
Yeah,
every summer.
why has that stopped?
I think it's just because it sort of like got to the stage where we were having to hire different companies and it wasn't really flowing as much. And then you try and ask the same people every year for the same sponsorship, which got a bit difficult. So I think we had a little bit of a break. We reinvented it and done a couple of rides around Sussex, up to Lewes and back and around that area and back. And then but yeah, but we run different things. We do various stuff. We used to do Santa runs. We try and keep it a little bit fresh, mix it up a little bit.
Sure.
But the one you're doing at the moment, and this is massively, massively important thing at the moment. And I know Al, you're doing a lot of stuff with this as well at the moment, but this is the Albion Memories scheme. Tell us about that, how it came to be, and what do you do?
Well, I think it was the PFA who obviously obtained the union. Once you're a pro, you stay in the union for life. So they contacted me. They must. I think they'd done it with every pro that reached over 50 or whatever it was, saying, "How do you feel?" Because the stats that come out are quite alarming. That I think it's something like if you're a professional footballer, you're probably four times more likely to get the effects of dementia or Alzheimer's, and I think it was something like five times more likely to die from it. So when you start hearing these sort of statistics and facts, you sort of makes you sit up and think. So I got tested. It was a bit of a weird test that I
Did they
did.
find a brain?
Well, exactly, yeah. But it was a weird one because you'd done smell tests and you didn't actually get the results back. It was a bit of a strange one of them ones. So I'd done the test. I assume it was okay because obviously they didn't contact me, but. But you do hear, I'm the same age as Dean Windass, who's come out recently and said, yeah, onset of dementia. So the stats are quite worrying. So off the back of that, I went to do a few, I went for a few meetings and sort of like sat in on a few meetings where they were, other groups, other football clubs run these memories groups and just to see what they were doing. And then I think the PFA contacted the foundation or they might even have contacted the club either way. It got back to us and we decided to put one on and it's been running now for I think it's nearly 2 years. It's absolutely brilliant. I absolutely love it. It's sad, obviously, in a way because you're dealing with people who've got dementia, but it's the feedback we get and the stuff that we do has been, it's really good, really good.
Give us a flavour as to sort of these particular events. What actually happens at them?
Well, we literally go in, tea and coffee, meet them at the door, come in, have a tea and coffee. We all sit down. We do it in the media suite at the football club in there, which is, if you've been in there, it's quite big. The teas and coffees there. So we sit down and I'll either get up and start talking about stuff that I've done in my career or, and basically we look at a date. I've got two brilliant helpers, Tim and Adrian from the, I think they're like the historians, of the club. So they know everything about the club. They know what games were on that day in the past. So what they'll do, they might get a clip up on the TV screen, and we just ask someone in the room, "Was anyone there? Does anyone remember these games? What's your earliest memories of going to Brighton?" The sad thing with dementia, obviously, is sometimes people can remember what happened 30, 40, 50 years ago, but can't remember what happened. Can't remember.
30 seconds ago.
Can't remember what they had for breakfast.
Exactly. So hopefully it sparks off a memory and gets the conversation going. And people, like I say, the feedback we've had from the carers come with them as well. And the feedback that we get, is brilliant because like you said, it's partly getting their family member back for a little bit.
I mean, I've been involved with some of these things myself, and it's like when you're talking to somebody who's it's mostly short-term memory that has gone. And when you're talking to someone, and it's like, it's the same. It might be a song that sets off a memory. It could be a football match, a certain player. So like, I've got family members that have been through this, and there's certain players from the past. Oh, I remember like going to the Goldstone. We all used to get into like six of us used to get into this old charabanc because it's only meant to have four in it, and like
It's
and
amazing the
going off
things
to sea.
the bizarre things that you actually do remember. I mean that they're a kind of minor detail in the great scheme of things, aren't they? But to you, to someone who, like I say, who's on that sadly on that road, those are the sort of things that they end up realizing. I mean, I suppose it's a horrible thing that when you're in the earlier stages, you kind of know that you're. You, it's like you've forgotten. You haven't forgotten what you're going to forget, and so those memories have got to be cherished. Is that how you kind of approach it, Guy?
Yeah, and I also get, I asked like people like Andy Rollins or someone, Alan Mullery, to come in and talk about their careers, and I mean, obviously the games that they played in. And like you say, off the back of this, the funny thing with, well, it's funny, for want of a better phrase, is I'm pretty convinced that since I've been doing this and I've learnt more about the disease, I'm more than convinced that my parents had dementia towards the end of their lives. It was silly little things. My dad used to love a cup of tea. And when I went around there, I used to go around there every day and feed him in the evenings. And he'd have a glass of water in front of himself. And I'd be like, Dad, you don't normally... I've never seen my dad drink water in his life. I used to think it was gin, first of all.
Maybe it was.
Yeah. But he... so I think he'd lost ability to know how to make a cup of tea. Silly little things like that. The microwave. I'd go around there and... I used to buy microwave dinners because make it so easy for it. It was the easiest microwave in the world. All you had to do was put it in, shut the door, and just turn it on to whatever time it said. And he could quite easily do it. And then it got to the stage where he was ringing me up. I was working Brighton, and he was, you know, are you coming round? What for? You know, well, I haven't eaten and that. And it was sort of, well, why not? It's quite easy, Dad. You know what to do. You just put it in the microwave. And it was, so I wasn't too sure if he was feeding himself properly. And in the end, I sort of like to, you know, he's hospital bound as well. I managed to get him out just before he died. The beautiful thing with it, I made me peace and that, and with my mum as well, because they both died at home. But I'm more than convinced they both had it.
Did you join the dots at the time, do you think? Or is it only later that you have?
It's, and this is going to sound, bear with me, because it's going to sound a bit strange. I feel a tiny bit guilty now, because when you've been at work all day and you go round and your dad's not eating and you can't understand why and you're like, Dad, you need to eat, mate. You get, you almost get a little bit, not angry is the wrong word, but you get a little bit peeved with it because you just think, I've got all this food here. It's running out of date. You've not eaten it. You're this, that and the other. And then
frustrating is what it is.
Yeah, it's also your own personal routine is turned upside down, isn't it?
Yeah, and like I said before to other people, your dad's your hero, you know, he's the strong man of the family when you're growing up, et cetera, et cetera. And it almost like they regress back into being like a baby, if you know what I mean. And he, in the end, like I said, he was hospital bound. We managed to get him out and it was, yeah, it's just the way it was. But you do, a little bit of you feels guilty because you just think, you know, I maybe overreacted a little bit there. But like you say, you're tired yourself and you're running around and you can't understand why all this is happening. But had I had the training before...
Sure,
I would have spotted the signs.
Okay, so you're running these sessions weekly. How do people get in contact to join these sessions?
Well, just get all the usual place, go onto the club's website, find the foundation page, and then contact us via the foundation and just say that you're interested in our groups. We run two of them at the moment. I think it's every 2 weeks we do them. So, like you say, they're really good. They've been really well, populated. People come along and have a chat, have a coffee, and... the worst case scenario, they're just getting into the media suite at the stadium.
You could have picked a room that had windows.
Well, the odd time we go down to the change room, we go down the change rooms and we do it in there.
That's a good one. You could with all the shirts and you could hang up different shirts from different players. And
absolutely. Just one quick question before we go to the ident guy. Now, it's interesting you're talking about the fact that the PFA got hold of you. Have you noticed a little bit of a sea change at all with the PFA since Mahéta Malango took over?
Yeah, I have actually. They've sort of like, there seems to be a lot more initiatives coming up as far as ex-players is concerned. I've been contacted about trying to arrange for ex-players to go on a fitness regime thing. They've some got some plan thing where they can pay for the gym use and all this sort of stuff, just trying to keep people fit. I think I need to get on myself. But yeah, so they are contacting me quite regularly. And it's, I haven't actually spoke to Mahéta, funny enough, since he's taken over, but they've contacted me on Mahéta's behalf because silly little things like I think it was a Bobby Moore day or something where people have to wear their shirts to work, you know, the shirts that they played in. And you can get hold of a Brighton one of that era. So I managed to source one for him there. And I think they were doing something in South Africa. And it turned out that the attaché of the Foreign Office in South Africa was a Brighton fan. So I had to quickly rush around and try and get a shirt for him. But they literally were giving me like 2 days' notice of all this stuff. So I was running around like a...
You never met Phil Shirley then, of Old Football Shirts?
No, I know. Yeah, of course, quite well.
The problem with Mahéta is he only does things for 12 seconds. But anyway, but moving swiftly on, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. We are brought to you in association with the fabulous Flowers Unlimited, Alan.
Flowers Unlimited, thanks very much indeed to Dave Costa, our show sponsor. We just want to point out that not only do we thank Flowers Unlimited for their support, but there are many businesses and institutions around the city that support Radio Reverb. It is a radio station that doesn't accept advertising, so everything comes from sponsorships, donations and grants. So if you know anyone that fancies sponsoring a show on Radio Reverb, there's plenty of music shows there, one for every genre pretty much.
Northern Soul?
Northern Soul. There's a Northern Soul show called Move On Up. I could do with a sponsor for that. beautiful link, Guy. Thanks very much indeed. Please get hold of us here at Radio Reverb or via the Albion Raw, and we'll put you in touch with the right show. But Flowers Unlimited, 175 to 177 Portland Road, Hove. Basically flowers, chocolate, champagne, all gifts for all sorts of occasions. Please, thank you, happy birthday, happy anniversary, happy divorce, whatever it is you want to say to friends and ex-friends and what have you. Or go to flowersunlimitedbrighton.co.uk. Tell them that we sent you, or tell them that you're an Albion season ticket holder and you get a 20% discount. So thanks very much indeed to Dave Costa of Flowers Unlimited for his continued support.
I'm Dean Gallagher of Brighton, Hove and Dishwit Samaritans. Many of us go to football without a care in the world as an escape from our everyday lives. However, many of us carry our burdens with us into the game and beyond. If you feel you need to speak with someone, call a friend. Or if you see a friend in trouble, please do reach out. Being truly listened to can make such a difference. You can call the Samaritans on 116 123 or see us on a home match day. Let's kick off the conversation.
Absolutely, indeed. Now, Guy, there's various other schemes. You harebrained schemes, obviously, most of them, but no, they're not. But one of the other new ones is the Heads Up campaign.
Yeah, we've got a number of young children and young adults. I think it's Mental Health Awareness Week, or it has been recently. So we're running a new scheme via, I think that is with the Premier League's help, to go into, I think we're going into schools. I think we haven't actually started it yet, but the plan is, I think, to go into schools and maybe go into like leisure centres with the older generation to put on football sessions and then just talk about, you know, mental health and healthy well-being really with everyone. We used to run a similar sort of thing there called More Than Football, which we used to run out of leisure centres for people who are sort of like 18 plus, where they come along, we put a football session on, maybe just play a game or something. We'll stop maybe halfway through and we'll talk about how their week's been or how they feel generally, their mental health issues, etc. And then after that amount of time, I think it was about an 8-week course, we used to then give them the bag of balls and the bibs and that, and then maybe say to them, can you chip in a quid a week to carry on playing at the leisure centre? And it worked really well. And we're trying to do that now, rehashing it, I suppose, in a way, with the Heads Up campaign, which I'm really looking forward to starting.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of linking quite well with the other campaign the Albion's doing with the Samaritans at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's, you know, a lot of the stuff that we're doing with the mental health stuff is, you know, from my point of view, obviously playing football, I can relate it to when you had an injury, say that you injured your ankle and you carried on with that injury, it would only get worse. So what did you do? You go and saw someone, you know, you got treated, you had treatment, you had recovery, you had et cetera, et cetera. And it's the same with your mind. You know, you need, if you've got something wrong, you need to talk to people, you need to get to the bottom of the causes and you need to sort of like, you know, get it sorted out. So it's, that's my role really going in there and trying to link the two really.
So, there are so many programs within the foundation. There's the things that you're, well, I can hear just in the tone of your voice that you're so proud to be involved in. Mm. But I mean, the remit of the foundation is, it's almost universal. So what else is out there? Even if you're not involved in it directly, what else is the foundation doing at the moment?
Well, you can become a community champion. You can support the foundation if you want by becoming a community champion, which I think is for as little as something like £5 a month. You can support us. Sometimes it's great when you get these major, you know, big companies putting lots and lots of money in, which, you know, we still encourage people to do.
Yes, but absolutely.
Also, you know, the people, no matter how small they donate, plenty of people donating small amounts always equates to big money as well. Yeah. So, and like I said before, I think we've got something like 35 disability teams, ranging from cerebral palsy teams to blind football, amputee teams, et cetera, et cetera. And we need to be able to put sessions on across Sussex for these people. And, you've seen that. You've seen what we do. And,
Well, I've just noticed that there's loads of stuff that Kieran Green's doing now, isn't it? In his
Yeah.
wheelchair. Tell us about Kieran.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, Kieran used to be on our courses as a youngster. Now he's on there coaching. He's doing back coaching disability football. I think he went off and started getting to involved in wheelchair boxing. And
What do you do? Throw them at each other?
but the thing is though, off the back of that, he got involved in wheelchair boxing. So he's actually then started to write some of the rules for it. And apparently, at the last anniversary ball, he was on the stage talking about it. They
Yeah.
think it might be turning into an Olympic sport. So, and he's the one who's
Wow.
writ the formula for it.
And
So,
we're talking about a fella here with cerebral palsy, aren't
yes, exactly. Yeah. So he's amazing. Yeah. And he's coming back. He's coming along to our Albion Memories group because he's going to put on some bocce sessions for us. Anyone who hasn't played bocce, it's a bit like the French balls, the ball game
Yeah,
where
yeah.
find a tart. Yeah, where you find a tart. It's a bit like with softer, like hacky sack balls from the old days. A bit like normal lawn bowls in a way as well.
Yeah.
Got a jack
Oh,
that goes out and you try and get near to the jack.
it's a good game. I've played it.
Yeah.
It's good.
You
So he's coming
usually
along
play
for
it drunk, AD.
it. It's a French, isn't it? French, sorry.
Me and our good friend Andy Bass, we used to have regular petanque sessions on the petanque terrain down by the West Pier.
They got one up at, Lancing Leisure Centre's got
Have they?
a
Someone's going to have to tell me the difference between petanque and ball one day. I don't
It's
know, but
exactly the same.
oh, are they? I
Yeah.
assume ball is literally the ball. So yeah, sorry. But anyway, back to Kieran. He's actually going to be an Olympic superstar.
Well, yeah, so he does that and he's played. I think he's played in the wheelchair rugby team as well for it. I think he's representing England at various sports. So it's fantastic that he's back. He's a good lad, Kieran, when you talk to him. And like I say,
I'm a bit concerned, Guy. I've got to be honest, because I with all the stuff that you've done with the foundation, you like to get your hands dirty. You like to try everything, and the thought of you doing wheelchair boxing frightens me.
tried wheelchair basketball because we run an Albion Games day as well. So basically, any companies that want to do some team building, team bonding, or
Yeah.
whatever it be, they'll be supporting the foundation as well. We're getting down to the uni, and we have probably seven or eight different teams. We compete in the Albion Games, which we play wheelchair basketball. We do amputee penalty shootout. So basically, you've got crutches and you're only allowed to use one leg at a penalty shootout. We also do blindfold penalty shootouts where you put a blindfold on, you have to put your hand on the ball and not take too big a run up in case you miss the ball. But
And
they tap the
then call
post.
yourself Leonardo Ojoa.
Yeah, they tap the post with a coin or something, a metal post, so you know where the goal is.
Right.
So yeah, and we play goal ball as well. It's brilliant. It's brilliant.
So I'm just thinking,
It's
if you
great.
take those crutches, I don't know if this is going to be too insensitive or not. If you take those crutches and sit on a wheelchair, you could have wheelchair jousting as well, couldn't
You do, you know what I mean?
you?
Invented another game there, to be fair.
The medieval games.
Absolutely. Now, actually, with these things here that you're talking about, I don't know if it's the same thing that goes on, but obviously the likes of the Albion's corporate sponsors get involved as well, don't they? American Express often send teams to them,
That's
and I've
fantastic.
been to some of and I've had a go up to, sitting on a power chair and
Yeah.
trying to play football. I mean, it's impossible. But the thing that I do remember about me going to these things, and we're talking probably 5 or 6 years ago, was the commentary of, and I don't think we've had you on the show since he passed away. Give us your lowdown on Peter Brackley.
Yeah, what a commentator. I mean, I literally, when I first met Peter, I think might have been at the Steve Darby's, what was that called, where he used to run the
Oh, the St. George's thingy.
he used to run over the uni, didn't he? The power chair football tournament.
That, yes, yeah, at the
Oh,
sports
it was
hall.
at Chailey Heritage, wasn't
Bailey, yeah.
it?
So probably how I first met Pete, come to think of it, doing co-commentary with Pete on the them tournaments. And he used to bring that silly little that little box of tricks, didn't he, where someone had
Yeah,
had
all the fart
a
noises and stuff
narrow
along there.
boy, all that
That's
stuff.
it,
Yeah.
yeah.
But Pete, and then we're very friendly with Pete over the years. And then, of course, he used to ask me along to his after dinner speaking stuff, and I soon quickly found out that it was to be one of his stooges, really. So every time I was, his favourite one was when Guy Butts played looked like a Greek god. Now he just looks like a Greek restaurant. I heard that about 5 or 6 times. The best one he done for me was he was doing a theatre show. over at Southampton. It was the 40th anniversary of them winning the FA Cup in 76.
Yeah.
So he said to me, come over at the Mayflower Theatre. There's about 2,000 Saints fans going to be there. And I said, Peter, because he knew I lived in Southampton, near Southampton. I said, Peter, I'm not going to go there, mate, because I used to play for Portsmouth. You do realise 2,000 Saints fans are not going to take too kindly me walking in that theatre. So he said, no, you'll be all right. Just come backstage, meet Laurie McMenemy. And Clive Thomas was the ref, I think, for the game. So he was there. So I met all them. You know, it was really good. And then he said to me, look, I've got your ticket. Hang around and watch the show. It's brilliant. We might try and replicate this over at Brighton, which we actually did in the end. So I've sat down in the audience. And then, of course, halfway through the show, Peter's come on doing his little skit. I think he was a chef from Birmingham, allegedly. A chef from Birmingham tried to poison the team in the fourth round or something. He's a West Brom fan. And he come out dressed as a chef with all blood all over his coat and a green chicken, you know, with a Brummy accent. And then he sort of pointed over my direction and asked the bloke to stick the spotlight down there. And, of course, made me stand up in front of 2,000 Saints fans. He ripped me to bits. They were booing me and everything. And then I thought, I've got to get out of here at some stage. How am I going to get out? Alive, basically. Luckily, the lights went down and I literally crawled out on hands and knees out. When I got in the car, I bombed it home and I rung him the next day. And yeah, but like I said, we ended up doing one in Brighton. We'd done one in Portsmouth as well, which went brilliantly.
Yeah,
but, I miss him every day. I literally used to ring him most days and have a chat. And you know Peter as well. And when you talk to him, he's such a funny man and his impressions and...
It's like nominative determinism, as they call it. It's like you are the butt. You are butt the butt of jokes.
He used to bring me and Kerry along as well and start talking about his, you know, his deceptive pace. He was slow.
I think the show with Peter's still in our archive, isn't it?
The show with the Weeder with Peter, I think it was on twice, but yes, we've got certainly one of them. I know I've got every single show going back to 2016, and I've got a few from before that. I mean, as much as Guy was talking about the fact that he was the butt of Bracker's rib tickling, I mean, I sort of exalt myself and stick myself on a pedestal here that I actually got one of his because I actually wandered into this wheelchair sort of day, wheelchair football day. And as I walked into this, the thing had already started, Bracker's is on the commentary. And he said, I'm not going to do Bracker's voice. Alan Wears from the Albion Roar has just walked in, and the hot news in is he's just been in hot negotiations, and we understand they are now negotiating good terms for a second listener. Now, I know that Paul Barber and Tony and others have been sort of like on the receiving end of it, and there's absolutely no way you can take offense. I mean, it was actually yeah, brilliant. He was lying. It was our third listener I was negotiating for anyway.
When you watch him in action, he used to get so sort of, not nervous is the wrong word, but obviously he was preparing himself to do whatever he used to do. So he used to be pacing up and down. But when you saw him go in action, it was just unbelievable. I mean, I was there when he had both his heart attacks, funny enough.
One was in Horsham, wasn't it?
Horsham one, and then another one in Worthing. So the first time in Horsham.
Used to be in Castle, yeah.
Yeah, me and Gary O'Reilly were there on the stage, and then three old blokes, we was waiting for everyone to come in, and it was taking so long that Pete was like looking at his watch, and then three old blokes walked in, and straight away he went hat and garden raiders like that. the person who run the social club or whatever it was got on the stage and started talking about the minutes from the meeting before. So Pete was like, come on, we need to get on with it. And then, but Peter literally gave him a bit of paper how to introduce him, and he of course he stitched the fella up, didn't he? He's gone. You know, we got Peter Brackley, who I think he said something like his favourite night was interviewing after a game at Portsmouth. The Rodney Marsh and George Best played in a game at Portsmouth. And after the game, they invited Peter out to a drink, and they ended up in Turkey. And Peter's then gone like a face, you know, pulled a funny face and gone, Torquay. Like, and then he started waffling on about something else, this bloke, and he goes, and he's done his stand-up show and all this sort of stuff, and he's been boring the country ever since. And Peter's gone, touring. It's just the way he set him up. It was so funny.
Fantastic. I mean, I can see, you know, I mean, like I say, I know that you were sort of, I'd say, his patsy, but
yeah,
I mean, I can, it's fully understandable that you know, you could miss him every day. I mean, he was, what a dude.
Yeah, just used to ring me up. It was, you know, a big Brighton fan as well, massive Brighton fan.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Yeah.
And okay, well, let's just before we finish, let's just quickly fast forward to the team now. Obviously, you're at the stadium most weeks doing bits and bobs, so you get to see us every week, and you're in and around the building and seeing training and players and stuff. So, I mean, the way that Fabian's got trains the players now, he wants them training with the same intensity that they play the game, right? Now, I know that Mark McGee had a certain fitness regime for you, which you really benefited from, but how would you cope with the intensity that Fabian puts in?
To be fair, Guy is 56 this month.
Well, he could still play.
But do you know what? Funny, I mean, I watched some of the games, and I think, I mean, I don't recall a time when we played. There probably was. I mean, you guys watched us, but I don't recall. You know, when they play the ball around at the back and it goes back to the keeper, I don't recall too many times where we had that luxury of. Because I'm pretty sure we got closed down most weeks by the forwards, and you know,
I think it was Gus, Gus Poyet that brought in all the playing around the back pit, wasn't it? Using Kasper Ankergren.
They talk about these high presses that teams do, but I'm pretty sure we got pressed every week. It's all the time. Whenever I got a time on a Paul Dickhoff running around after you know, you can a little sort of like a little fly buzzing around you, like a little.
You used to play for the Albion, Paul Dickhoff.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't recall ever a time standing on the halfway line with my foot on the ball, looking around and going, oh, I'll give a 10-yard pass there and get it back and have a cup of tea. And but then, you know, they look fitter. They obviously...
I was about to say, question for our listener. Can you imagine Guy Butters and Danny Cullip doing what Van Hecker and Lewis Dunk do now?
I can imagine what Danny... I know what Danny Cullip's answer would be, but it's a family show.
No, we can't, yeah.
Again, it's totally, you know, that... They only have one up front that you've got to mark. It seems, you know, it's you've got two in front of you, you know, sort of screening in front of you and full
back. To be fair, you did always say to us that you actually, whoever your centre-half partner was, whether it was, I don't know if it was, and I don't know if my timing's right here, whether it's Virgo or Adam Hinshelwood or Danny Cullip, whoever it was, they were the ones that did the running around and you just did the mopping up.
Yeah, mopping up or heading. Yeah, so I still see Dan Hart because I still play for the Vets team, Brighton Vets. We've got a little Vets team.
Brilliant.
And when they turn up.
And Dan Harden plays now and again. I said, Dan, same as mate, you know, if the ball's in the air, get out of the way because I'm coming through like a steam train. But anything over the top, mate, you better get in there and do the running. Back anymore. I've never done it when I played, let alone now. Imagine that. God, I run even less now, obviously. So
so even in the 20 years, or the, you know what, yeah, it's 20 years since the sort of like the tail end of your career, football certainly at Brighton, but football seems to have just changed so much, isn't it?
Yeah, well,
the last game that I saw Guy involved with was very recently, actually, down at Worthing when opposition manager deployed this new formation of 22-1.
Was that Jeff Stelling that did that?
Yeah, Jeff Stelling trapped everyone on, didn't he? Yeah. Brett's.
That was the Rocking Horse. Thank you. Yes, it was the Rocking. That was a hell of a day, wasn't it?
Joe Wilkinson, everyone played. Yeah, he trapped them all on in the end. Still beat him. Arla played. You want to mess with him?
Right, we got 5 minutes left now. So we've talked about obviously your work and your career and what have you, and touched on a whole load of things. But there's one thing that that this is where we probably exclude AD a little bit. Last Sunday last weekend you went to Portsmouth for a gig. Now this is where you and I can actually just sort of you know, be a bit sort of smug here. But you love your northern soul, don't you?
Love it. I grew up in through the '80s, late '70s, early '80s, and I was there with the obviously Quadrophenia coming out. So the mod revival happened when I was in sort of like second year senior school. So I always remember walking around with me Parker on and going up I live near Heathrow Airport, and the airport bowl up there, the 10-pin bowling alley.
Yeah.
You go up there, it was common knowledge that you used to go up there with a rubbish pair of trainers on, walk out with the bowling shoes on, so you wear them all around. So, and then I caught that bit where that sort of transitioned a little bit into Northern Soul. So I do remember with the little beanie things on my head and walking around with the moccasins on and all that sort of stuff, bomber jacket, etc. So good old days, yeah. So I always loved that sort of music from that era.
You kind of love the mod stuff, the soul, the Motown.
Yeah,
basically, yeah. I mean, because you look a sharp mod, don't you?
Well, you know, try
like
it.
Me. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I try, but yeah, I fail, but I still love the fashion, like you said, with the old desert boots and whatever else. And turning up the other day to watch it, I went with a few. It was my birthday treat, as you said. I'm quite rightly 56 end of the month, so I got treated from a couple of mates, and Rach come along as well, and a few of the wives. And there was about six, seven, no, sorry, eight of us in the end, all on the back row of this dress circle bit, all dancing. You know, it was quite a tight theatre, but I was stood up dancing, and I think a couple recognised me from Portsmouth, so I kept my head down a little bit.
Because what we're talking about here is that, you know, there was the BBC Proms a couple of years ago. They had the Northern Soul Night there. And I don't know if you remember, let's rewind 35 years when The Commitments came out. Remember that film, yeah. You know, set in Dublin, a soul band in Dublin. And from there seemed to be a whole plethora of nine-piece soul bands coming out and doing their routine. Now, I think on the back of this BBC Proms thing, there seems to be a few more bands, a few more sort of reviews coming out of you know, 11-piece bands doing a Northern Soul review rather than sort of like the soul that a lot of people know. It's great to be, you know, going to these things at this time, isn't it?
Yeah, and there was like a story behind it in between the songs, you know, like they play sort of four or five songs, and then there was like people talking about their history when they were growing up. Some bloke saying that his dad bought him a scooter, and he come downstairs and he said, he goes, I'd never been so disappointed in my life because it was a Vespa. And I'm thinking, I'd love one of them now. Imagine that, keep being disappointed that someone's bought you a Vespa and gutted it weren't a Lambretta. But, you know, little stories like that, but the whole evening was brilliant. And like you say, there's nothing better than... when you've got favourite music anyway, but when you actually hear it live, a live band you can't beat anyway, can you? You know, with a saxophone going and a trumpet.
A pretty faithful reproduction of what those original songs were.
Yeah, amazing. And the singers, I mean, you like you say, you've watched it, the singers were outstanding, you know. Fantastic. If they'd have sold, you know, like their own CDs outside, I would have gone and bought one, but unfortunately they didn't. But and it was, you know, it was sort of a gutting that the night was over in a way, because I could watch that sort of every week. Really.
Long I think after I was washing tonight, my hair.
Yeah, long after tonight is all over, eh?
Well, whilst you were doing that, Guy, I was watching some angry Welsh girls called Panic Shack, and it was much better. So there you go.
Northern Soul covers
relevant released record, an album, debut album released in 2025. People,
I am not playing out that particular. Of course, I'm playing out Northern Soul. Well, actually, we started with Northern Soul. You know, this show. Don't tell Mike Vickers that we probably owe him hundreds in royalties. But
we're going to play South, out, mate.
Yeah, we got
none of this northern stuff.
No, it's as pure as music could ever be. It covers every single emotion from A to Z and back again. It cannot be beaten. And the fact that actually, bizarrely enough, it comes from America's working class cities and transposed itself to some of the grimmest northern towns and became popular there is just an absolutely baffling story. But hey, the likes of myself and Guy have picked up on it, and I know there's a few of you out there who are loving all this sort of thing. So, yeah, keep the faith. Long may it continue.
Okay. I'll go and get my wig on.
I see what you did there.
Anyway, thank you so much to Guy Butters for joining us. Just quickly, Guy, how can people get hold of the foundation if they want to get involved in anything?
So go on the club's website. There's a foundation page on there, and just get in touch, and they will like leave an email or leave a message on there, and they'll get back to you.
Fantastic. So thank you to Guy Butters. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been AD Packham, and this has been the Albion Raw on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online, radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast, and in association with Flowers Unlimited. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again next week. Thanks. Bye.